ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage. That part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Maher. The highway from Chicago to LA may be the most famous road in the world. It's now celebrating 100 years since it was designated Route 66. Later, a gritty history of the mythical highway. Despite the songs and behind the small town charm, it's a story of danger, death, and racism. Later, our kicks on Route 66. Plus, warfare ain't what it used to be. AI, drones, and satellites are giving little nations the battlefield grunt once enjoyed only by big powers. Senior Carnegie Fellow Steve Feldstein will be here to discuss the future of war as big tech squares off against big guns. But first, to Canberra, to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, welcome.
Thank you, David. Good to speak to you.
Look, Anna, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks, but it seems that the federal court unanimously regards Pauline Hanson as capable of racially vilifying people. This is astonishing.
Well, this is quite a significant moment in this very long-running court battle, which dates back to 2022, David. There was a social media post that Pauline Hanson put online, and that post said that Maureen Faruqi, the Green senator, should, quote, pack her bags and piss off back to Pakistan. So it was a very inflammatory post. It was one that caused the senator great concern, and so she went through the process of taking it into the realm of the courts, and you know, she's given her permission for this post, and it's detailed to sort of be discussed through doing that, and also through acknowledgement. We've had discussions around the need for, you know, some of these comments from politicians to be publicly aired so that the public can understand what's being said. But in that process, you know, we had a court finding and it was appealed by Pauline Hanson. She was trying to get the court finding overturned. And today we've had the decision by Federal Court Justices Melissa Perry, Jeffrey Kennett and Elizabeth Bennett. They have found that that appeal is not warranted. But that isn't going to stop Pauline Hanson from continuing with her sort of legal quest to see this changed. She has confirmed that she will take this to the High Court. So she will commence, she says, an appeal in the High Court of Australia.
But isn't it interesting? You know, the Labor Party is really hesitant to say that there's anything racist about Pauline Hanson. Ditto the Libs, they don't want to let the word pass their lips. But the federal court has the bravery to say that she's racially vilified someone.
Well, David, I think there's two different things going on here. There's a court process which has found this racial vilification approach and the ruling should be upheld. That's a court looking at, you know, hate speech laws and, you know, 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act and making that finding. Politically, though, the problem that the government and the opposition have had for some time now is making the distinction between any criticism they might have of Pauline Hanson as One Nation leader or her policies, but the potential that that criticism then falls on the voter who might be attracted to One Nation at the moment. So, you know, suggestions or criticisms directly that involve claims of racism, for example, there's a fear about the community that's looking at One Nation now, considering that Labor in particular or the opposition might be saying that they hold those principles or those values. And there's a deep concern that this could then rust on some of those swinging voters who are adding to One Nation's opinion polling numbers and make them feel alienated more by the establishment. So there is also a reality that I know it's been said many times, but, you know, the deplorables moment is a great political fear. That, you know, the Hillary Clinton
approach, the basket of deplorables.
And the potential for things to then flow on in voter land and how this could be weaponized on things like social media is a big deal. I do think that there'll be ongoing conversations within political parties about this, though.
There has to be a way.
But let's just think about when Channel 7 aired the Spotlight program, for example, a few weeks ago, and Pauline Hanson was talking about and had put to her as a question whether she thought Islam was a disease. And she, you know, answered in the affirmative to that claim. Like that. There are a number of other statements which may now be considered by different people in various spaces who might have the finances and the inclination to take other political or other legal action to really consider their options around other things that have been said by the One Nation leader. However, at this stage, I do think that there is, as we can see, great soul-searching and internal consternation within political parties about how you might address concerns with One Nation's leader as opposed to that flow-on effect that voters feel that they're being attacked or they're being discredited or diminished in that process.
Remarkable. But equally remarkable, no, just amazingly remarkable this week, is the sense of triumph that the Prime Minister is exuding in the aftermath of the Labour conference. Why is he on such a high?
I think it was Annabel Crabb who had dinner with the Prime Minister recently on camera, a very relaxed dinner, just with, you know, seven cameras or something around them. But was talking about how the Prime Minister prepares food and how careful he is about how he strategizes on things, whether it be a meal or whether it be this conference. And there was a huge amount of preamble to this. And there's really two schools of thought. One school of thought, which the Prime Minister holds to, which is that the conference was very open and transparent. A lot of decisions were made in a subcommittee process, and it was very orderly and, in his view, fair. And for the most part, there were fair and balanced outcomes on the floor of National Conference, but not the old sort of drama-filled arguments and people speaking against each other publicly of conferences gone by. No, there was a little bit of drama, but not a lot, that's for sure. And there were some people who did feel frustrated by the process, but largely it does appear that his caucus colleagues were appreciative of the way it was run. Whether or not the Labor grassroots is feeling heard and whether or not some of the kind of very broad language that was settled on, you know, fairer goan resources, for example, when it comes to what some people wanted to see, which is actually significant changes to, you know, taxing of gas, for example, whether those things have led grassroots membership to feel, you know, this is a leader who's taking a middle ground and we trust that he has more information at his disposal about everything that's happening, or whether there is more of a sense on some issues like the Middle East that within Labor people felt silenced or their views weren't addressed, I think will shake out over the next couple of weeks/months. But from the Prime Minister's point of view, he couldn't be happier because in reality, he actually came out largely on the winning side of almost all these policy debates. And there was no embarrassing moments on the floor of the conference where he as leader was, you know, overruled or had to concede. I think he comes out of it feeling like this platform is one he can live with. But David, it was last week that you and I were discussing the different perceptions of how binding the platform is. I think the Prime Minister's made quite clear that even though those in the Labor Party wing think this is, you know, now what should be implemented, but the timeline is the issue, well, I think he's made pretty clear that he will decide when things come into effect.
He could not be clearer. I wonder whether he is aware of the view of left-wingers in Australia, the people on the left, surveyed by the Pew Research Group, wonderful American research group recently, that found 9 out of 10 of the left in Australia hold an unfavourable view of Israel. Australia itself is up there with the most disappointed countries of Europe with Israel. But here is this 9 out of 10 figure, and yet he does not seem to be willing to address the full impact of what's happening in the Middle East in Labour policy.
I think the Prime Minister's had a very strong view behind the scenes for some time now that recognition of Palestinian statehood was a huge, in his view, symbolic move from Australian Labour. He went to the United Nations General Assembly. He made that announcement essentially, you know, side by side with a number of other middle power countries, all taking the step together to do something that was highly contested. And to be honest, up until the time when the Prime Minister said he was going to do it, I think a lot of people within his own party, let alone other political parties in Australia, thought it wasn't really a live possibility because of the pressure that would come on any political party that made that decision. Obviously, the coalition was never going to go down this path, and they say they would overturn it in government. But I think the Prime Minister does feel that he has taken some pretty enormous steps towards trying to address some of the issues within the Labour grassroots movement. But at the same time, we have this ongoing concern that has been raised, including quite unusually by the Israeli embassy in Australia just ahead of the conference, that the platform went too far and that they didn't feel that it was fair, that contested things about settler violence. And then on the other side, on the other side of it, Ed Husic, who's become a real kind of one of the very few within Labour, in fact, often the only one within Labour who's willing to speak out publicly against things, who wanted the Labour platform to go much further to recognise genocide. And that's something that the Israeli authorities have long denied, but has been, you know, discussed very much in legal processes internationally. That's not something the government and the Prime Minister have an appetite to do. We're in interesting times for the Labour movement. It's hard to know where some of these conversations will go. Some of the outcomes will be out of the Prime Minister's hands because they'll be based on international events. But I think you're right that there's still going to be potential disconnect between what a pragmatic Prime Minister does to try and avoid headlines and division and what those who back him think should be the path forward.
Thank God we've got you to explain it all. Anna, Chief Political Correspondent of SBS, thank you once again for coming on Late Night Live and exposing yourself in the way that you do. Coming up, how big tech is changing warfare. In the past, great powers were great because they had huge armies, aircraft carriers and nuclear arsenals. But war is changing. Technology has leveled the battlefield. Small powers can inflict huge damage, not with a missile, but a drone. Steve Feldstein explores this shift in his new book, Bites and Bullets, Global Rivalries, Private Tech and the Future of Modern Warfare. Steve is a senior fellow in the Democracy, Conflict and Governance Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Steve, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
Is this what we're seeing playing out in Ukraine at the moment? New versus old ways of warfare?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a pretty potent example of that occurring right now. And, the trajectory has been surprising from day one. We think back to the invasion in 2022. Few thought that Ukraine would be able to withstand or hold out against far larger Russian forces for more than a few weeks. And here we are, 4+ years later, and Ukraine is not only holding out, but in many respects, they have turned the tide and have actually seized momentum thanks to their innovation against Russian forces. So it really is eye-opening. Every day, I think we're learning new things about the ability of smaller, nimble forces to adapt against more inflexible, larger ones.
But are we also seeing the reluctance of old military to give way to new military?
That's right. I mean, that dynamic is playing out within Russia. That's also playing out currently in Ukraine, where, just in the last few days, the kind of young 35-year-old defense minister, Mykhailo Fedorov, was summarily fired. And perhaps now he's not fired, but there seems to be a bit of a separation between the old guard in Ukraine and the kind of newer tech-savvy cohort who are demanding change and reforms, and many would say would give credit to in terms of turning the tide in this current conflict.
Money is part of this, isn't it? I'm thinking of the attacks by the Houthis on shipping in the Red Sea, that what the Houthis do is cheap, but the response is enormously expensive.
That's right. I mean, there's a real asymmetry is what a lot of people are calling it, both in terms of the response back to the Houthis or, frankly, the response back to Iran and its use of very cheap, mass-produced Shahed one-way attack drones that the U.S. and other partner forces don't have great ways to counteract. I mean, they're coming up with ideas. Frankly, a lot of the best ideas that they're now deploying come from Ukraine and represent sort of cheaper technology that they've been able to adapt for that conflict. But, you know, the U.S., like Russia, like other large forces, have been caught a little bit on their back foot. And they're scrambling to kind of figure out what this new way of war means and how to get around and deal with adequately this sort of cost asymmetry that means that very cheap drones can inflict a significant amount of damage. And yet the way to counteract that oftentimes involves shooting off multi-million dollar interceptors.
Let's go back to the Cold War, as you do in the book, and have a look at the way in which the West asserted its superiority then. In particular, the way in which the military and the government and sort of free enterprise worked or didn't work particularly well together.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really interesting story with the Cold War. And there's a couple aspects I think are important to point out. One thing I would really highlight is the fact that for the duration of the Cold War, the U.S. employed what was called a closed innovation ecosystem, which meant that the government labs, government money largely drove innovations that were kept for the most part in-house. So they weren't commercialized. They were kept within the kind of government structure used for national security. But it also meant that the dynamism that we see today in Silicon Valley was kept in check. After the end of the Cold War, a decision was made to shift to an open innovation ecosystem. So many of the innovations like ARPANET became the internet, GPS became commercialized. Many of the aspects in our smartphones like Siri came from natural language processing devised in government labs. So all those things kind of shifted to this open ecosystem. And the result of that was an explosion in innovation, an explosion in investment, and really made Silicon Valley what it is today.
And that is as a partner with the military.
Yeah, well, that was sort of a longer undertaking. So, you know, their Silicon Valley's birth actually was a result of government labs finding a synergy with university researchers and allowing a limited degree of commercialization over time. But what sort of then happened later on is that actually after the Cold War, government money in the defense sector started to dry up. And so the commercialization ethos really took over. What we're seeing now at this moment is a resurgence of government money, a resurgence of defense tech investment, and a newfound interest in Silicon Valley, not just from national security startups in companies like Palantir or Anduril, but even from big tech firms, big AI firms, Anthropic, OpenAI, Google, AWS. They're all interested in getting defense tech contracts and are making a big push to partner with the Defense Department in ways that we haven't seen in a long time.
But the United States is still building aircraft carriers, isn't it? It's still making missiles. It's still involved in heavy traditional warfare.
It is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's sort of the question is, what's the balance, right? In that wars are different. not every war will be fought like Ukraine. And you have to kind of keep an eye on what the kind of wider variety of armed conflict will look like. And so what that means is that you want to make sure that you still manufacture the things that are significant in different types of battle. But you also want to be nimble and flexible and usher in and allow and manufacture the new also. And that's where I think there's been a bit of a struggle. Rather than sort of pivot and embrace mass-produced drones, new innovations, it's been a little bit hard to kind of turn the Pentagon and orient towards that. Now, I think that actually is starting to happen to a greater degree. Frankly, things like the Iran war can be real shocks to the system and point out in explicit ways where the military is falling short and why it needs to up its game when it comes to embracing new innovations. So it's happening, but it can be slow going, especially in a big bureaucracy like the Pentagon.
This is a big question in Australia. Do we need submarines anymore?
Well, I think it depends on the nature of the threat you're addressing. The short answer for me would be yes, particularly if you're worried about a threat from China. And frankly, now, you know, the question is, can you start to change around what you have so it's manned versus unmanned? You know, can you start to use sea drones in a bigger way? In other words, can you complement what you have and let that be a force multiplier as opposed to simply investing in large legacy, exquisite submarines? I mean, that I think is a debate that needs to continue being had.
Steve, surely Russia is mass producing drones right now, and that the drone advantage is brief and will soon bend to Russia's advantage.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and I think there's a couple variables that are important. So one thing I would say is that drones will not continue to accrue the same advantages today, tomorrow, as they do today. That will change. And part of the reason that will change is precisely one of the, you know, big ideas in the book, the adaptation imperative, which is that countries recognize that coming up with sufficient ways to counter drones is important. And we've seen this historically, that when you gain an advantage in attack, you know, the defender eventually comes up with innovations to blunt that advantage. And so I think the same thing is starting to happen already. I think, you know, there's a lot of money being invested in direct energy, munitions, in drone interceptors to stop drones from coming in, other layers of defense. And so I think over time, the significant advantages we see will diminish. And so that's one point that's worth thinking about. I think the second point is worth thinking about with regard to Russia is that there will come a point where their economy simply isn't able to sustain the war footing that it's on. The amount of money, the personnel going towards mass producing these munitions, at some point, it just won't be feasible. Now, I don't know exactly when it reaches that level and how much more the economy can sustain. There's lots of debate and argument about that. But I don't think it's something that's inevitable and sustainable all the way into the foreseeable future either.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Steve Feldstein about the new ways of fighting war, which he's examined in his book, Bites and Bullets. Steve, let's go to the rising technological powers that you have identified. And I presume you identify them as peaceful for the moment, but becoming potentially great military powers through innovation. Who are these powers?
Yeah, there's several of them. And, you know, I'll name a few. I mean, I pinpoint nine overall. They include Turkey, UAE, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, Brazil, South Africa. I think I got most of them at this point, Taiwan. And, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, they really kind of run a pretty wide diversity of interests and viewpoints and even regime types. And so some of them, many of them already are involved very actively in proxy wars. And that's one of the things I really document throughout the book. So for example, obviously Iran, it's pretty widely known what they're doing in terms of arming Hezbollah, the Houthis, and others. Turkey has been involved throughout the Middle East as well and beyond. It is, you know, sending its TB2 drones and intervening in Libya, in Sudan, in Azerbaijan, in the Nagorno-Karabakh armed conflict a few years back. And so it's not that these are powers that sort of in the future might become military rivals. Already, they are using military innovations to assert their authority, to exercise geopolitical influence, particularly in second-tier, third-tier conflicts that larger powers are too busy or too distracted to really intervene in. And that's where they can have a pretty significant role. So I think we're already seeing a lot from some of them as it stands. The UAE is another country where its interventions in conflicts, particularly throughout sub-Saharan Africa, is pretty remarkable and something that oftentimes can run contrary to U.S. or other interests.
But their new technological expertise also makes them a target, does it not? I'm thinking particularly of Taiwan.
Sure. And actually, you know, another example of that would be the UAE, in which I dedicate a whole chapter to, which is in the sense that, you know, as you become as you gain geopolitical heft, as you become an exporter of different arms, you also become a larger target in terms of your economy. And we've seen that play out with Iran, right? In the Iran war, you know, Saudi Arabia, UAE, a host of other countries have been the recipient of ballistic missile attacks, drone attacks, and so forth on their infrastructure, on their data centers even, because those assets are now viewed as so key to a country's power that whether it's for solely civilian use or perhaps dual use, either way, it's infrastructure that's now being attacked. And these are countries that find themselves increasingly in the target sites of different countries.
And what's the key technologies we're talking about here?
Well, you know, it's a variety of things, but I mean, obviously a lot of it relates to AI. So if you're looking at data infrastructure, that's cloud computing facilities, it's data centers, it's where you have compute and other kind of technologies grouped together. It's sensors and radar that are necessary to help guide the systems that are being used. So, and then even, you know, frankly, with Iran, one of the sort of things that it's really trying to do is expand the war, escalate the war horizontally to hit purely civilian infrastructure that has not got even much to do with technological innovation, but certainly will lead to punitive economic pain for the countries and their citizens themselves.
You obviously, a book of this kind, a study of this kind, cannot be done without a strong focus on China. You talk about the way in which China has integrated government, military, and technical innovation. But what is China doing there that the United States isn't doing? Isn't the United States, as we were discussing a moment ago, coming together in the same sort of way?
Yeah, it's a mixed story with the U.S. So, you know, one of the things I talk about with regard to China is military-civil fusion. You know, this idea that massive government subsidies are going towards building up private sector innovation in, critical strategic areas, whether it's trying to develop more indigenous semiconductor manufacturing capacity, AI models, different types of hypersonic missiles, whatever it is that, party leaders have identified, they are very good about charting 5 and 10 year and 15 year plans towards achieving those objectives and then putting resources towards accomplishing those. And to some degree, the U.S., especially under the last administration, under Biden, has moved toward doing the same thing. It helped power through the passage of the legislation, the CHIPS Act, which was really consumed with trying to build up America's ability to produce the most cutting-edge semiconductor chips, which were viewed as essential to its military capacity, and so on. But, you know, there's a couple things with that. One, it's never been as fully committed to this sort of government-led push as China, even at sort of the height of what Biden was trying to do. And under Trump and the current administration, those efforts have somewhat fallen by the wayside. Some of the subsidies remain in place, but a large amount of government funding going towards research, R&D, the various types of things that China is subsidizing massively, that has wavered quite a bit. And a lot of it has actually been slashed under this current administration. So I don't think that it would be fair to say that the U.S. is emulating or following this model in terms of what China is doing, even if at different moments recently, it has seemed to start to do so.
The great powers are uniquely vulnerable these days, are they not? Because they depend on such vulnerable things like undersea cables, gas pipelines, satellites. These are surely such easy targets for causing havoc in warfare.
Yeah, you know, I think that's right. And I think we're also, you know, we have an interesting dynamic where power, you know, exercised by a few large powers is starting to ebb, and that there's kind of a growing number of other countries that are sort of seizing geopolitical power and seizing capabilities that allow them to do very disruptive things against larger countries. I mean, I think overall, you know, one of the points I make early in the book is that we are also living at a moment with increasing conflict. We are far removed from the post-Cold War peace dividend days where conflicts were few and far between and largely relegated to fairly remote areas. I mean, Europe is facing a significant land-based war right now. The number of conflicts currently last year numbered about 65 conflict events, which is the highest number that the world has seen since 1946. So not only is the global environment more volatile and more conflict prone, but there is an increasing ability for countries that are smaller, as well as insurgent groups, to disrupt the infrastructure and the capabilities of larger powers. So that's a powder keg.
But you also raise in the book this grim possibility that when AI is engaged in warfare, no human being will be making decisions about what gets destroyed, who gets bombed, what's blown up, that it will be machine against machine. What happens then?
Well, we're not there yet, and we have time. And you know, one of the things that I've tried to raise in the book, especially near the end, is to signify what could happen, but also to sort of flag the fact that we have a window of opportunity to slow things down, or at least to come up with some common understandings and common principles between large powers about how these AI systems potentially would work. I mean, the bottom line is that we are kind of moving increasingly towards autonomy. We are increasingly removing human judgment when it comes to targeting systems, when it comes to making other sorts of decisions on the battlefield. Or at the very least, we're compressing and delegating more of that out to machines. Over time, you know, that will lead, I think, to a pretty hazardous situation where the amount of authority that's directly wielded by humans in a rapidly shifting battlefield where war is happening at breakneck speed will diminish. And I think it's those dynamics and understanding better how to deconflict and avoid inadvertent escalation now that are extremely important to address.
But doesn't that take us back to an issue which is as old as warfare itself? The willingness of the combatants to obey rules.
That's right. And, you know, that's obviously been a challenge and one that has never been solved. I think we took some pretty important steps as an international community post-World War II with this, you know, with the establishment of the Geneva Conventions and the kind of universal uptake of international humanitarian law. It's not perfect. It's not something there are always violations, and now more than ever. But it still provides a basis for countries to have a common understanding of what ought to be prohibited and what is allowed in military conflict. We are seeing an erosion of that right now. And so that's something that is certainly where there's certainly room for concern.
Do you see any respect for those rules in the war that is going on at the moment in the Middle East?
There is diminishing respect for it. I mean, I still think the rules matter. I still think the norms persist. But I think that military combatants are increasingly willing to flout them because they think they can get away with it. Or, as in the case of Iran, they're desperate to. And you know, that's not to also dismiss the fact that even the president of the United States in the last few days has threatened, not carried out yet, but has threatened massive damage to civilian infrastructure, which seemingly would be a violation of international humanitarian law as well. So the rhetoric, I think, is dangerous. It's something that, frankly, President Trump has been very reckless with in terms of those threats. And then when it comes to the activities undertaken by Iran, by Israel, occasionally by the U.S., There's real questions about whether lines have been crossed when it comes to deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure, which really is off bounds, off limits when it comes to what these laws say is allowed in war.
Steve, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
I've been speaking to Steve Feldstein, Senior Fellow in the Democracy, Conflict and Governance Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of a new book about the shifting ways we're fighting wars. It's called Bites and Bullets, Global Rivalries, Private Tech and the Future of Modern Warfare. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, the truth about America's Mother Road.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. I get your kicks on Route 66.
That's Nat King Cole's 1946 chartbuster celebrating America's fabled highway. Never mind that Cole would have struggled to get a hot meal or a bed for the night along much of Route 66 in that era of Jim Crow. It's 100 years this November since the old road down from Chicago to Oklahoma and then west through Arizona to the Pacific was designated Route 66, to come to be celebrated in song and prose as the road from ruin, a highway to adventure, to renewal and freedom. Celebrations are underway, but the historian, Dr. Daniel Malowski of Arizona State University, wonders what we're remembering here. Yes, small town America, but what about the danger, death and racism? Daniel is the author of the book Route 66 and the Formation of a National Cultural Icon, Mother Road to Mythic American Byway. Daniel joins me now from Arizona. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you.
How did this road come to be called Route 66?
The origin of the name actually originates with a dispute amongst the highway commissioners. They were trying to establish the first map that would outline all of the numbered highways for America's first highway system. And roads that ended in zero, so those numbers that ended in zero, like Route 40 or Route 60, were highly prized because they marked transcontinental routes, and all the highway commissioners of the various states thought that that would bring the most traffic and hence the most tourism business through their states. And Cyrus Avery, who is the commissioner of the Oklahoma State Highway System and a member of this federal board creating this map, proposed this highway from Chicago to Los Angeles to bring traffic through Oklahoma, but also to connect two of the most strong economies, regional economies at the time, the Los Angeles economy and the Chicago economy, with a highway that ran right through Oklahoma. He wanted the number 60 for that to designate it as a transcontinental route. Other highway officials objected, however, because it wasn't transcontinental. It was sort of half transcontinental. And so they proposed, well, it's largely sort of a connector route. Why don't you just call it 62? He didn't like that name, went searching for other numbers, and then found an unused number, 66, thought it sounded kind of nice, and picked that, and they agreed, and that is how it came to be.
Was it even a highway?
So initially, no. Most of these highways are actually more suggestion than reality at the time, particularly in the American West. So you had a movement called the Good Roads Movement, which actually started with bicycle enthusiasts. America had sort of a dreadful highway system, mostly funded by local entities. You know, large cities like New York or Chicago within the city limits would have nice paved roads. Those would sort of deteriorate into sort of dirt tracks out in the country. And early automobile adopters, first these bicyclists wanting to sort of bike out into the country or finding it hard to do so on these muddy dirt tracks, and then early automobile enthusiasts even more so. And so you have this grassroots movement that wants to create an American highway system. They start lobbying the federal government for this, and this takes quite some time, about 20 years before you get sort of real action. And that's when you finally get federal funding put behind building real roads. However, since none really existed outside of sort of the city limits of major cities, it took some time to build that out. So really in 1926, when this map is finalized, most of the roads outside of sort of major urban areas and certainly outside of the northeastern United States are more sort of dirt tracks or even sometimes simply just suggestions following railroad right-of-way and things like that where no road exists at all.
Even at its best, was it anything more than one lane each way?
So in many parts of the United States, yes, it was only one lane in each direction and actually not paved well into its, you know, sort of history, not into the 1930s. Does it, you know, through New Deal funding, does it get fully paved? And it actually becomes the first highway that is fully paved from end to end. So it does hold that distinction. But in most parts, since most of its route runs, you know, sort of west of St. Louis, Missouri, which is sort of the last major city you hit on Route 66 until you get to Los Angeles, it is simply a two-lane road. And certainly through the first several years of its existence, it's actually just gravel in the area.
Yeah. So within a few years of it being named Route 66, the Depression strikes and the great drought of that time, and it becomes an escape route.
Yes, very much so. You know, and it's, you know, it is a road that, you know, has a lot of symbolic meaning to it because of these sort of big sort of spectacle events that happen. But the idea of it being sort of a route of last chance redemption and escape and deliverance, much of that is the iconography of the Great Depression. And so you have the Okies, of course, who are fleeing the Dust Bowl. Oklahoma is the place hardest hit by that drought. They are fleeing along Route 66 to Southern California. Most of these people are agricultural workers, either former farmers who have lost their farms or farm hands. And so Southern California is one of the areas not hit by the Dust Bowl. Agriculture is still thriving. And so they're searching for sort of new work, redemption, new lives in California. And so you have, you know, iconic novels like The Grapes of Wrath, set along Route 66, documenting the plight of these, you know, Okies fleeing the Dust Bowl and seeking redemption in Southern California. And then you have the Works Progress Administration, through their artistic efforts, documented this as well. And so many of those iconic photographs taken by Dorothea Lange, for example, contribute to that imagery of Route 66 as this route of escape and redemption.
But it also worked, didn't it, in good times, to bring prosperity down the road?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it is a strong driver of economic development. And so many of these towns become fully oriented around, you know, automobile services, tourism services, you know, that is the lifeblood of their economy. And so in, you know, particularly in places where there isn't a lot of other economic activity going on, so many of the small towns, particularly in the American Southwest, so Arizona, New Mexico, places like that, the towns would almost be completely oriented around servicing travelers on the road. And so, you know, a small town that might only have, you know, 1,000 people in it in terms of permanent residents has an enormous number of gas stations. You know, it'll have like 25, 30, yes, maybe 50 gas stations, you know, and it's not the local residents that are using that. It is all the travelers on the road. And so you get this sort of oversized tourism, automobile services economy that develops around servicing Route 66 travelers.
And motels, because you can't get very far on this road. You have to sleep along the way.
Well, yeah, and there's, you know, there's a number of contributing factors to that. Certainly it is a two-lane road, and so you're not going to be able to travel at the kind of speeds you can travel on modern interstate divided highways. Automobiles, certainly through most of this time, are not as capable either. They don't, they're, you know, far more inefficient than they are today in terms of fuel economy. They need refueling more often. They're slower. They're prone to more breakdowns. And so you're not making a lot of progress, you know, each day in your travels. And so the motel industry literally grows up along roads like Route 66, starting with actually just sort of auto camps where people are kind of camping in their cars and have some basic facilities. And that evolves into motor hotels, motor carts, and then the, you know, kind of modern motels we know today.
So at the same time that it's being celebrated in song, this road is becoming choked with traffic, you write, and it becomes really dangerous.
Yes. In fact, Route 66 garnered the nickname Bloody 66 because it led the nation in highway accidents and highway deaths through most of the post-war period. And you have this massive shift of population that happens in the United States out of the Northeast and the Midwest to the American South, and particularly the American Southwest. And all of those people that are coming out of the Midwest are using Route 66 as the route to get to Southern California. And so just a phenomenal number of people are doing this. You know, at one point in the late 1960s, you had 400 people a day relocating to Los Angeles County every day over a period of years. You can imagine the volume that is on that road. And then, you know, through most of New Mexico and Arizona and the desert part of Southern California outside of Los Angeles, it's a two-lane road traversing mountains. There's no shoulders. You know, there's often little room to maneuver. And so head-on collisions were common. And one of the things I write about in the book, the little town of Williams, which is, you know, a very tiny town, again, you know, population around 3,000 people at its max, had a hospital with 8 trauma surgeons on staff, which is a phenomenal number of surgeons for a town that size. But they were servicing all of the traffic accident victims, you know, because that is the mountainous part of northern Arizona, and, you know, a lot of traffic accidents, a lot of severe traffic accidents, particularly because cars aren't as safe. It's the pre-seatbelt, pre-airbag era. And so you have this, you know, sort of phenomenal carnage happening on the road.
On Radio National, we're celebrating the centenary of Route 66, and I'm talking to Daniel Malarski, the historian of the highway. Daniel, tell me about the Negro Motorist Green Book. This is not something I had ever heard of.
So this is a guidebook, and there were a number of these travel guidebooks. The Green Book is the most famous, that is helping African Americans navigate travel along American highways during the segregation era. So this is something that actually was a national effort. So it wasn't something exclusive to Route 66, but the Green Book and other guidebooks like it were published for African American motorists to be able to safely navigate, you know, the American highways and be able to access the services they needed to travel. And so what it would list is, you know, basically they would verify, you know, where you could get gasoline, where you could, you know, stay in a hotel, what restaurants would serve you. And in many cases, there is a cottage industry that is documented in these books, because most of the, in many of the towns, most of the commercial establishments, commercial restaurants, you know, commercial motels, hotels would actually not refuse service. They would refuse service to African-American travelers. And so there were African-American residents in many of these towns that would open their homes to travelers and rent out a room and offer them a meal as a way of sort of accommodating them when the official accommodations were unavailable to them.
When did Route 66 become empty again?
So Route 66 is bypassed over sort of a period of time as the interstate highways are built out. And so, you know, much of the, you know, sort of twilight era of Route 66 is really sort of west of St. Louis, Missouri, where the highway, you know, the new highway, in this case, Interstate 40, has to be built in sections. And so that is really a period from 56 to 1985, so about a 30-year period. where one by one sections and towns are bypassed in favor of the new interstate highway.
And what happened to those little towns?
So most of them suffer severe economic decline. There are a few winners in that. You know, if you happen to be a small town that is on the new route of the interstate, you know, the business area in your town tends to shift, but the overall economy does okay. And so Flagstaff, Arizona, as an example, you know, their business center sort of shifts from downtown to the south of town, where the interstate comes just south of there. And Kingman, Arizona is another small town that, you know, just happens to be connected on the route of Interstate 40 and actually benefits quite greatly from that. There's a lot of distribution centers and other sort of highway trucking aspects that develop its economy and actually grows. Part of that. But most of the small towns, you know, are bypassed. Either they can sort of see the interstate from their backyard, but there's no exit to their town, or the route simply bypasses them by, you know, several miles. And there's, you know, sort of no reason for travelers to go through their town anymore. And in many cases, they suffer, you know, significant decline, you know, population declines of 50% or more, most, if not all, businesses closing in the town, you know, severe economic depression.
So what's there now? Is there a sort of a Disneyland version of Route 66?
So some of these towns do reinvent themselves around Route 66 tourism, which is really this sort of mythic version of Route 66. It's, you know, there's sort of a handful of businesses that are trying to sort of recreate a really sort of a faux Route 66 experience. So they're typically, they'll have a, you know, sort of a diner that's offering these sort of 50s Americana, burgers, French fries, shakes, gift shops. There might be one or two of the old, you know, sort of motor court motels that have been restored. Yeah. You know, have the big sign, and it's sort of offering you a, you know, stay in an authentic Route 66 motel and have, you know, an authentic Route 66 meal, and then of course, you know, buy trinkets of various types in the gift shops. And so that is sort of being marketed to these tourists. And actually, Seligman, Arizona, which is one of the towns that is bypassed completely by I-40, reinvented itself in this way. And it has this one street corner where you have that array of businesses. And it has a very, you know, they've purposely kind of made it sort of a back to the 50s vibe, which has, you know, some connotations in terms of harkening back to that era of segregation when not all were welcome. And then one of the ironies of that is that, you know, a lot of their tourists are actually international tourists coming from all over. Yeah. And so, you know, it actually is possible to, you know, and they have these junkets where people can fly into Las Vegas and get on the tour bus and be taken to Seligman and, you know, sort of have their full Route 66 experience and take their picture on the road and have their milkshake and then get back on the bus. And I've actually been in Seligman and witnessed this, where you'll see this like tour bus of, you know, all Japanese tourists or all German tourists or some group like that getting off, you know, and they getting this sort of faux American history experience marketed to them as, you know, this kind of authentic experience.
Daniel, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Oh, you're welcome.
Daniel Malowski, keeping alive the history of Route 66, author of Route 66 and the Formation of a National Cultural Icon, Mother Road to Mythic American Byway. Daniel's also written some beautiful articles in The Conversation, which you can look up at any time. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. Trump has put the bombing of Iran on hold. ICE agents are executing again. It's tariff time for the world once more. Measles are having a field day in the United States. Thank God we've got Bruce Shapiro, our man in America, to make sense of it all. That's next.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.